This is Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sidorick. And that's the sound of hundreds of protesters peacefully marching in Boston yesterday, calling for justice for Breonna Taylor, after a Kentucky grand jury decided not to bring charges for killing Taylor against the police officers who shot her. And it wasn't just Boston. Protests and marches took place in Sacramento, Colorado Springs, Minneapolis, Nashville, and many other cities around the nation. An outpouring of emotion, anger, sadness, frustration over police violence in America. Writing today on WBUR's Ideas and Opinions page, Cognoscenti, former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick says, quote, "Enough. Policing in America has to change for peace in America to exist." And he joins us now. Governor Patrick, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Chris, thank you. I wish the circumstances were different.
Yeah, that's putting it mildly. I'm going to start with a question, Governor, that we've asked many of our guests in the last 6 months. 2020 has thrown a lot at us.
Ooh-wee.
Yeah. How are you doing?
Thank you for asking, Chris. I am, in 2020 terms, I'm fine. You know, my family is safe and healthy, and we are mostly together, and we're for the first couple months. We are able to put food on the table, and we have still things we can laugh about. But we're also very mindful and heartsick about the fact that is none of that, and much of that is not true for an awful lot of our friends and neighbors around the Commonwealth, around the country.
Yeah. The piece you wrote on Cognoscenti, you'll get to a couple specific things from that in a moment, but I'm wondering if you could take us back to last week when you heard the news out of the grand jury. What did you think? How did you react?
Well, you know, as a lawyer and having listened to some of the analysis, I wasn't entirely surprised, but I will tell you that setting aside my legal training, I wanted the outcome to be different, but I expected this to be the outcome. I know it is true that prosecutors have a tremendous amount of discretion over how to present charges to grand juries and whether to you know, and their ability to persuade grand juries of to charge. To charge police. You know, police are an important part of the society. Police unions are an important political feature. And there's a certain amount of our political rhetoric, Chris, that makes it seem as if the price we pay for safety is a tremendous amount of latitude given to police. But it's that sort of equation that I think a lot of us feel and have felt for a long time we've got to rethink.
Yeah, I do need to acknowledge, obviously, one of the challenges of 2020 is we're all doing this remotely, having a little bit of trouble with your line there, but we get some folks trying.
Sorry.
That's okay. It happens. It's our reality these days. I want to refer to a specific line in your piece, if that's all right. You write, quote, "I try my best to make people comfortable before plowing into hard subjects, but when it comes to the violence in black people's lives, especially when it involves the police, I'm so tired of white people being comfortable, or is it complacent?" Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, look, I think it was important to acknowledge that this is a change in tone in some respects. It's an impatience that I feel, but I don't often express. And I do think that I have worked really hard in my public and private life to try to be understanding of different and competing points of view. And I know that when it comes to race, an awful lot of the work is making white people comfortable with the subject before you can get into it. But, you know, I've been thinking a lot about just take the protests that have been happening since George Floyd was killed. The outrage was nearly universal. It was unavoidable to be able to witness something like that and not be affected. And there was and there have been alongside those protests you know, large numbers of people, varied backgrounds of the people who turned out in various cities and communities around the country. And there have been hooligans. I hate violence. I hate it in all forms. There was an analysis just the other day by Huffington Post that 93%, this is an analysis of all of the incidents of reported violence in all of the protests, 93% of the protests have been peaceful. But the focus that you see in the media on the violence, as if that disqualifies or delegitimates the gravity of the demand that we have justice and a different way to think about safety and peace in communities, is so enormously frustrating. And I think that's what I'm trying to get at. We have to get past, we have to learn to separate, you know, hooliganism from the legitimate anguish that people are expressing and the absolute need for change.
Yeah, I think that's why it struck me, is it was such a different tone for you. I think you're kind of known as a consensus builder. I'm thinking back to when you jumped in the presidential race. Your main message was, we need to find ways to love and understand each other. Was it difficult to show a different side, or can you talk a little bit about that decision to take that tone?
Well, I wish it wasn't viewed as such a different tone. You know, one of the things I talked about in my race and that I believe is that we have to get past this notion of false choices. You know, I talked about and still believe I'm a dedicated and proud Democrat, but I don't think you have to hate Republicans to be a good Democrat. I don't think you have to hate business to be a social justice warrior. And in the same vein, I don't think you have to hate police to believe Black Lives Matter. And I think we're going to have to get past the rhetorical boxes we put ourselves in. The lives of Black people count. That does not mean that the lives and the value of police or of anybody else don't count. But what we've been doing, it seems to me, is reaching a whole host of decisions that treat the lives of everybody else as important, and the lives of Black people, particularly in interactions with the police, as less. And that those accumulated decisions and actions are things we have to confront. They are points of evidence in how we have to reform the systems that we have. And it's, by the way, Chris, it's within our power to do this. We're not dealing with any problem that we as a society haven't made. And so these problems ought to be within our capacity to care about and to solve.
Do you worry at all? You mentioned kind of the reaction, the overwhelming reaction in the immediate aftermath of George Floyd's killing and that video coming out. Do you worry at all about losing momentum to this cause? You know, I saw a Pew Research study from earlier this month that said support for Black Lives Matter is down from where it was just last June. In June, 67% of the country expressed some level of support for the movement. That's now down to 55%. I'm wondering if we risk losing a moment when there's real systemic change possible.
Well, I think there's always that risk. I think there's always been that risk, and I think that's one of the reasons why we haven't had systemic change, or at least sustained change. That is not to say we haven't made progress, much of it in my lifetime, in race relations and in racial understanding, and in many of our systems. That is not what I'm saying, but I am saying that we've got to get to a place where we stop being so focused on the methods, and focus instead on the substance. The taking by pro athletes of a knee is a deeply peaceful, profound protest. But we spent a tremendous a lot of time under the president's leadership criticizing that form of peaceful protest. And there have been, as I said, marches in Boston and in cities all around the country that have also been overwhelmingly peaceful. But we focus in on the violence, and that takes us away. And again, I am not condoning the violence. I hate it. I reject it. And I have loved the fact that so many of the organizers of the peaceful protests have been the ones telling the hooligans to cut it out. But focusing on that at the expense of the deeper issue is a serious problem. I want to make sure that we don't make that mistake.
Yeah, to that point, to the substance aspect, I'm sure you know the police reform bill is at the State House, still in conference committee. I want to play a little bit of tape from last week, your successor, Governor Charlie Baker, talking about Taylor's case as an impetus for the state's police reform bill.
I really hope that at some point this fall, we have a chance to appropriately celebrate the signing of legislation that will hopefully deal with and solve some of these very important and significant public policy and public safety issues going forward.
So we've heard from some activists that are concerned that the longer this is taking, the more likely it is that the legislation could get watered down and be less meaningful. Are you optimistic that Massachusetts is going to meet this moment and pass meaningful reform?
I take nothing for granted. And given the urgency of the moment, given how temperatures flash around this issue, and given, frankly, the depth and expertise of many of the members of the legislature, I really don't understand why we don't have a bill. I appreciate that that the governor asked for action this fall instead of, you know, whenever it is the legislature decides to get around to it when they're back in regular session after the new year. And he has a lot of influence with legislative leadership. I hope he'll engage, and I hope he'll get folks to agreement. I know that there's some parts of this bill or the proposals I've read about that are not easy. You know, qualified immunity, for example, is among the hardest issues. I think there is a solution there, and I hope we get a compromise. And I hope the bill is meaningful and not just a, you know, another round of better training, and so, but really an opportunity, not that that isn't important, but an opportunity to think about so many of the, to think in fresh ways about so many of the things we ask police to do that, you know, intact communities used to be able to do, you know, dealing with mental health issues and substance abuse issues, dealing with truancy, and frankly, so many of the issues that surround poverty, and we've been starving our strategies for dealing with many of those issues, and it has fallen to the police. In many respects, it's also fallen to teachers, and so we have an opportunity to rethink so much of that in marvelous creative ways with the help and input of the communities themselves.
Yeah, you mentioned qualified immunity. That has been a major sticking point here. I'm wondering what you would say to, say, law enforcement officers who might be listening, thinking, you know, hey, I go out there every day. I put my life on the line to serve and to protect, and average citizens can't understand what it's like in the heat of the moment. What would you say to someone like that?
First of all, I honor their service, and I honor those who come to that service understanding that building a relationship with the community is a lot better for their own safety and for the safety of the community, which is why a tried and true idea of community policing where we have enough officers out of their cars, walking the streets and building relationships with people is a strategy that works. But it isn't just conventional policing we're talking about. It's about having other professionals with other competencies available to help with things that really aren't about policing. They aren't about maintaining order or crime solving. And I mentioned some of them already. And in terms of qualified immunity, look, I may not be as far along that spectrum as some of the advocates. I think there is a place for qualified immunity, but I think what we have in the name of qualified immunity is absolute immunity. And I think that the limitations on information about the habits of police officers who don't abide by the rule, the lack of rules, the lack of transparency, the way the you know, so-called blue wall falls down and protects everyone. You know, I've talked in the past about a case I had where I litigated I was the lawyer for a medical student who was roughed up by the police, and the police came to trial and testified that they had independently written in their own hand an account of what happened, And it was a complete coincidence that those two statements were word for word, commas and periods the same, misspellings the same. And we're supposed to accept that behavior. That is the sort of thing that has to change. And if we build a relationship with policing that is comprehensive, it isn't just about policing, it isn't just about the men and women in uniform, but about how communities are rebuilt and knit together, and the various services, public and private, that enable that, then I think much more transparency when the police step out of line is frankly even easier for the police.
Governor Patrick, we're going to link your piece on our website, but I just want to ask you before I let you go, if folks who are listening are walking away from this conversation with one thing, what do you want that to be?
Hope. I hope that folks won't give up. I hope that the folks in the streets, from whatever community they come from, won't give up, won't let up on the pressure. I hope the folks who can't be in the streets but deeply care about rebuilding bridges between each other and learning again to take a chance on our neighbors, that we have a stake in them and they in us, won't give up. And I hope that the folks on the on police forces all across the Commonwealth and other and elsewhere, who know that there's a better way, won't give up. We could get to a better place. We're going to have to get there together and get there soon.
Deval Patrick's former governor of Massachusetts. You can find a link to his WBUR Cognoscenti piece at our website, radioboston.org. Governor Patrick, thanks so much for your time.
Chris, thanks for having me. Take care.
If you've seen The Departed, you know nobody likes a rat.
I got this rat, this annoying, heat-eating rat, and it brings up questions.
This year, it's not just Frank Costello who has a rat problem. It's the whole city of Boston. Since the beginning of the pandemic, complaints about rats and mice in neighborhoods all over the city have spiked. So let's look into it. Here to discuss is Leo Boucher, Assistant Commissioner of Boston Inspectional Services. Commissioner Boucher, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And also on the line with us is Boston City Councilor Ed Flynn, whose district includes South Boston, the South End, and Chinatown. Councilor Flynn, welcome to Radio Boston.
It's good to be with you, Chris.
And we also want to hear from you. Have you noticed more rats in the city recently? Have any crazy rat stories or mice stories you want to share, or tips for dealing with them? You can call us 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Commissioner Boucher, let me start with you. Can you give us a sense, how many more rat complaints are you getting this year compared to years past?
So our numbers percentage-wise were up considerably at one point, probably about 30%. Interesting. Those numbers reflect a number of things, not the least of which is folks are calling in the same complaint multiple times. And that just gives us an indication that there is a serious problem or an infestation, and it's certainly something we want to address immediately.
Councilor Flynn, I know this is an issue you've been working a lot on. You called for a public hearing recently. What are you hearing from your constituents?
Hearing a lot of similar concerns that Leo mentioned, but concerns that rats and mice are running throughout many neighborhoods of Boston. A lot of the restaurants have closed or are closing, so there's no food supply for them. So they're going through a lot of the garbage bags that are left on the sidewalk and in the street. So it is a significant problem. It's a quality of life issue. It's a public health issue.
Yeah, let's dig into that a little bit. In terms of a public health issue, obviously nobody likes seeing rats running around the streets or, God forbid, in your house. But can we talk a little bit about what is the actual health issue that this presents people with?
Well, one of the points is obviously rats can and do carry disease. Rat to human transmission is not something that's very common, but if there's a proliferation of rat urine or rat feces, it's certainly cause for concern. So it's obviously within everybody's best interest, particularly us as a municipality, to try and eliminate the food sources and eliminate the number of rodents on the street. All the rats need are food and water. They don't need anything extravagant. It doesn't have to be spring water, and it doesn't have to be filet mignon. any type of food refuse, any type of water, puddles, stagnant water, things of that nature will suffice as a food source.
Again, I'd love to hear anybody who's got rat stories. 1-800-423-8255. I actually have one from when I was living in Brighton. My wife and I were out walking our dog along the street and down Sutherland Ave. Dog just kind of all of a sudden dives into a bush, and we're like, oh, great, here we go. And she pulls out what looks like a dead rat, and it is the biggest rat I think I've ever seen. And we're both like, that's gross. Drop that. She drops it, and it runs right across my wife's feet, who freaks out and runs all the way back to our house and locks the door behind her. I'm curious, is this just a pandemic thing, or were there other factors here? I know we've seen folks who have said some of these rats are as big as cats or bunnies, that they seem to be doing all right despite the lack of food.
So the cat and bunny analogy, sorry, counselor. So the cat and bunny analogy might be a little far-fetched. Rats grow to be about a pound and a half. And as most folks know, you see a rat, it becomes very sensationalized, you know, and obviously it does evoke panic, and it does create panic. You know, I've dealt with situations in my own home. I've been in other people's homes where they've had serious infestations, and obviously been involved intimately over the past 20 years in infestations across the city. So that is one of the primary things. I mean, obviously, you know, your first impression is that it's dirty, it's, you know, it carries disease and things of that nature. And we certainly want to do everything we can to eliminate people's fears.
Go ahead, Counselor. I know you were trying to jump in there, too.
Yeah, I just want to echo that as well. You know, the public health of our residents is the number one priority. But making sure that our neighborhoods and streets and sidewalks and playgrounds are safe for everybody. And that's what we're really doing here, is working together with city officials, with residents, with neighborhood organizations to make improvements to make sure that every neighborhood is clean and healthy so that our children and families can live in great neighborhoods.
All right, let's go to the phones here, 1-800-423-8255. We've got Janet in Brighton. Janet, you're on. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Yes, I just want to report that I have a neighbor that puts out big chunks of bread every single day. She's done it for a year and a half, and I've called inspectional services. And there's rats over there every day. I see them. They're coming over to my yard. They've inspectional services has come out and been very nice and put out a bait box in my yard, but they can't stop her from feeding the rats.
Janet, let me ask you. Have you talked to her about this? Does she know that you're?
Yeah. Yes, I talked to well, they don't speak English very well, but I've talked to the husband that does speak English, and he just shrugs.
What are they trying to feed? Birds?
I think she might have a psychiatric problem. I don't know. I'm a psychiatric social worker, so I think she's got some kind of issue, but I think, you know, the squirrels, his birds, and then the rats, and they're all over her yard. And they say because they're Buddhists, they can't kill them. But the point is that inspectional services can't get them to stop putting out big chunks. This is big chunks of bread. This isn't just the little bird seed.
Yeah.
It's like loaves of bread every day.
All right,
and this
Janet.
Isn't going on for a year and a half.
Well, best of luck for you. Watch your toes when you're walking across the yard, I guess. So I think that does speak to the challenges that you guys probably have, though, in terms of you can tell people what they should be doing, but there's only so much you can do in terms of actually cracking down on some of this, right?
So that's correct. I mean, in some situations, we would issue sanitary code violations. If what Janet said is true and she's got some psychological issues, and if, in fact, that is true, we've got other city agencies that we utilize in order to address situations like that. So we could deal with our Age Drawn over at the RLD Commission, who are terrific, very good outreach. I'd be interested in having Janet's address. I mean, I don't know it off the top of my head, but I've got two inspectors in Brighton. I'll certainly speak with them later on this evening and see if we can come up with a group effort to try and educate folks. I mean, feeding is big a problem as there is out there. I mean, people for years, I mean, traditionally and in many neighborhoods, I've got an 80-year-old relative who feeds the birds every day. And I talked to him about it and explained to him all the residuals that can occur. So it's something that's it's kind of traditional and very, very difficult to deal with. It's quite difficult to get somebody to stop doing that. I mean, it might be the only thing that they do during the day. Might be something they look forward to. But we would certainly do everything in our power to bring in some other resources to see if we can't convince them that what they're doing is wrong In the meantime, as I said, if Janet can feel free to reach out to me tomorrow, and I'll be more than happy, or even today, more than happy to address it for her.
All right, there you go, Janet. Let's go back to the phones. Tom in Fitchburg's up next. Tom, what's on your mind?
Oh, hi. I was just wanting to comment that if anyone would like to see an active rat colony in the heart of the city, the Porter Square T station on the commuter rail platform after dark, you sat there for about 15 minutes, and there are hundreds of rats
doing all their
little rat things. It is kind of vile, and the first time I experienced it, it scared me quite a bit at first, but then, you know, I kind of watched them for a while. I was waiting for the train, and it was late, and, you know, they just did their little rat things, and it was kind of fascinating.
Tom, but, what are you thinking? That's how the horror movie starts. Get out of there, man.
It is a little horrible, but kind of, you know.
All right. Well,
kind of like watching ants. So I just wanted to pass that along. Anyone who wants to observe, that's the place to go.
Thanks for the tip, Tom, and I will not be taking your advice on that. So
I'm not going to take Tom up on that offer either.
Yeah.
Just getting back to Janet's call, is the hearing that we recently had, the co-sponsor of the hearing was Liz Braden from Alston and Brighton, too. So Liz is on top of this, working closely with inspectional services and with public work. So, you know, we're doing a lot of enforcement, responding to requests from residents, inspections, enforcements. I think there also needs to be a public awareness campaign of properly disposing of your trash. Disposable barrels, too. We had a pilot program in the South End. It worked pretty well. So there's different ways we can continue to work together to address this quality of life issues. And, you know, I'm confident even during this pandemic, during this difficult time, that we're able to solve this or make some major significant improvements.
All right, back to the phones. 1-800-423-8255. Matt in Merrimack, you're up next. Welcome, Matt. What's on your mind?
Thank you. We're about a half hour north of Boston suburb. It's a pretty wooded area, you know, not city-like at all. But for the past 3 years or so, we've been dealing with this issue in town. I kind of brought it up. I live next to an elementary school in town and noticed holes all over the school. And my neighbor across the street found one in their windowsill and another one found one in their garage. So I set up some traps. This is 3 years ago. I set up a few traps outside my house. Within 15 minutes, outside around my fence line, I caught one. So I was like, oh, boy.
15 minutes. That's not a good sign.
No. And so I brought it up, and there's just complete denials. And then the following season, complaints started going all through town, still denials, and they haven't done a thing about it, and they're still around. There's a weird smell that they give up if there's a collection of them. So it's like a musty smell, but and they're still all around, and the selectmen want nothing to do with it, neither does the Board of Health. So it's really been a tough issue.
All right, Matt. Well, thanks for calling. I appreciate that, and best of luck to you. So Matt raises a good point there that's been going on for a few years now. This is a problem that is not exclusively due to the pandemic. Rats have been an issue at times in the city in different neighborhoods. Is there more that you think that Boston could be doing outside of pandemic times to deal with this problem?
I mean, there's always more that you can do. Anytime you see an uptick like this, Councilor Flynn alluded to a good point. Public education is critical, letting people know how to store their trash properly. I mean, the primary source for rats is the trash in the city. So we do enforcement. I know that the Public Works Department, the Code Enforcement Police, do enforcement. We have enforcement capabilities under the State Sanitary Code, which actually the town of Merrimack could also utilize. It's the same code statewide, so they could utilize that state code in order to deal with anybody who's in violation. But there are a number of different things that we do as well. We've got an older sewer system in the city, and there's a lot of water and sewer work going on, and the city's doing a great job in trying to update and upgrade some of these systems. But we do significant amount of subsurface baiting. We do sewer baiting on a regular basis in many of the neighborhoods where we have an uptick. But education is so critical. Trash storage and trash disposal are the two biggest issues that we deal with, and those are the most critical for us to deal with in order to eliminate, or not so much eliminate, but at least eradicate what we can for a rat population.
Yeah. All right, let's go back to the phones, 1-800-423-8255. Bob in Cambridge, you're up next. Welcome, Bob. What you thinking?
Hi, oak trees. Squirrels like acorns. How about rats? Do rats like acorns?
Very straightforward question.
That's a very straightforward question. Rats will eat anything, any type of food product. Dog feces, not to be disgusting, but people not taking care of their dogs, leaving their dog feces around in their backyards. We've seen major infestations occur because of that. They'll eat berries. They'll eat any type of vegetation. They can get into people's gardens, flowers and vegetables and things of that nature. So the short answer to acorns is yes. I don't know if it's a preferred diet, but I'm certain that they would eat them if they had to.
I mean, when you eat literally everything, then will they eat blank? Yep. I think the answer is yes, right?
Yeah, pretty much so. Pretty much so.
Back to the phones. Donna in Jamaica Plain, you're up next. Welcome, Donna. What's on your mind?
Hi. There's a ton of construction going on, residential construction, commercial construction, and also digging up of streets, replacing the gas lines, replacing the water and sewer lines. My question is, does this contribute to the problem? And if it does, is there anything that can be done proactively when these things are occurring so that the neighbors surrounding these areas don't get infested?
That's a great question, Donna. What do you guys think?
That's a very good question. Go ahead, Counselor.
I would agree that it has an impact. I'm seeing a lot of construction taking place in South Boston in the South End, and I do see a lot of rats because of the ongoing construction. Also, Donna, with the ongoing construction, I do see a lot of illegal dumping of construction equipment or materials. You know, just dropping garbage in someone's neighborhood. We discussed that as well at our hearing. So I'm asking for us to increase those fines. I also called for a city council hearing on water and sewer related issues. I think I'm going to have that hearing sometime over the next 30 days, and that's something I'm going to be able to ask the Water and Sewer Commission staff about what they see on construction projects and rat pest control issues. So it's a good point. I know Leo will have some more information, but I'll definitely follow up with you on what the Water and Sewer Department thinks about that specific question as well.
Commissioner Boucher, I want to ask you a question. I know last week you guys announced that an aggressive campaign to deal with this problem, and that I read that part of that includes dry ice. Could you tell us a little bit about that and why that is the way to go?
Absolutely. So dry ice is basically carbon dioxide. It's a gas, and dry ice is a solid that turns into a gas, so it sublimates. And what happens is you utilize it to do baiting in rat burrows. So in the rat holes where the rats live, in the burrows where they live, what we do is we put the dry ice into the burrows. It's basically a pound and a half per burrow, depending on the burrow size. You close the burrow, and what ultimately happens is as the dry ice sublimates, the fumes disseminate throughout the burrow system and, for lack of a better word, euthanize the rats under the ground. It's very successful. It's not dangerous. You're not utilizing a pesticide. It's very good to use in parks and playgrounds. It's very good to use in any type of open space and field. And most importantly, it cannot be used near structures. So we've been very successful, extremely successful in dealing with any type of rat burrows and rat holes that aren't in close proximity to a structure using dry ice. But that's just one of the tools. To piggyback on Councilor Flynn's comments, the Water and Sewer Commission, when they do a water and sewer project, they forward the plans here to ISD, and we take a look at the plans and determine, based on neighborhood activity, whether it's a high, medium, or low-risk sewer project. And Water and Sewer will sub the pest control out based on that. In addition, at ISD, if you pull a lawn form permit which is an alteration permit, an erect permit, or any type of demo, soil borings, things of that nature, you're required to provide a rodent control plan for your project. We've been much more aggressive with those inspectors going back multiple times. That construction might not be the cause of a rodent problem, but it'll certainly cause displacement, and it'll certainly make those rodents move to other locations where they can live. You know, you upend somebody's home, they have to go someplace else to live, and that can be a contributing factor. As I said, it's not generally a cause, but it certainly contributes, and it certainly will displace rats and move them to other locations.
Yeah, that makes sense. Let's go back to the phones here. Dorothy in Sandwich, you're up next. Dorothy, what's on your mind?
Actually, it's Darcy, and I just got my question sort of answered, but I wanted to bring up a funny story. My mother grew up in Brighton, and she told us all the time when we were children the story of a donut shop on the corner catching on fire and hundreds of rats just pouring out. So I think the rats have been in Boston a really long time. And I did want to bring up the construction and the permits that people have to pull and having a I don't know if it's a containment part of it, but there was a New York Times piece, I think like 3 or 4 years ago, talking about the increase in rat problem there, and they were attributing it to a lot of new construction and buildings being taken down, and part of that was that they had to apply for or had to present a contamination.
Yeah, like a plan,
permit.
Basically. Yeah. Dorothy, thanks for the call, and thanks for the story. Appreciate it. So I do want to ask you both, because we've kind of hit on it a couple of times here, that we can address the problem, but ultimately we're not looking to get rid of all rats here, right? We're not trying to wipe out a species. So is there a way that we can live in harmony with the rats in our city?
Council?
I would say we need to do everything we can to eliminate them. If they're a public health threat, public safety issue, quality of life issue, it's about working together, city agencies, residents, neighborhood organization, the business community. But our residents deserve a neighborhood that's free of rats, and we're going to continue making progress on it. It's not a glamorous or sexy issue, but it's nuts and bolts of city government. That's why people pay taxes, is to have to live in a healthy and safe and neighborhood environment. And nothing is perfect, but we're working hard on it.
All right. Well, that's Boston City Councilor Ed Flynn, whose district includes South Boston, the South End, and Chinatown. Councilor Flynn, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Chris.
And Leo Boucher, Assistant Commissioner of Boston Inspectional Services. Commissioner Boucher, thank you as well.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate your time.
Since the Celtics, the Pats, and the Red Sox played yesterday, it's time to check the score. Now, usually I'm on the other side of the mic for this, but this is kind of fun. Today, we're joined by Boston Globe sports columnist Chad Finn. Chad, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
And I get to ask the questions today, so you're stuck with me, Chad. I have to start. I wanted to start with some good news. I wanted to start with the Pats, but I just can't stop thinking about the Celtics team. So we're going to start there. They lost Game 6 of the Eastern Conference Finals to the Miami Heat, 125-113. I have a lot of thoughts, but let me start with your kind of headline, Chad. What are you thinking about this team?
Well, it's frustrating because it feels like a lost opportunity. The Heat wiped out the number one seed in the Eastern Conference, and that seemed to open a path for the Celtics. I think what a lot of fans who are frustrated today overlooked with that was there's a reason the Heat took the Bucks out of the picture. They're really, really good, and we found that out over the six games. They just didn't make the mistakes that the Celtics made. They're a little deeper. They have the best big man in the series. They're a little bit better shooters. And anytime the Celtics did something wrong, they seemed to capitalize on it. So it feels frustrating today that the Celtics season ended the way it did. But I think if you step back and look at the big picture, last year they were knocked out a round early. They lost a lot of high-end, well-known players off their roster. And this really wasn't expected this year. To me, putting the frustration from last night aside, it feels like this year was a pretty big leap forward for them.
So you consider this a successful season?
I do in the big picture. I mean,
that's not a very Boston take right there.
Yeah, the ultimate goal is it's win a championship or nothing is enjoyable or fun, right? That's kind of the mindset we've gotten into. Yeah, it's the way it's been the last 20 years or so with the sort of the the bar the Patriots set and that the Red Sox followed, and, you know, the Bruins and Celtics each won a championship too. But last year was an extremely frustrating season to follow the Celtics. They lost in five games in the second round to the Bucks. Kyrie Irving basically quit on them halfway through that season, halfway through that series. And then Al Horford surprised them by opting out after the playoffs and leaving and signing with the Sixers because he thought he had a better chance of winning a championship. And they lost three guys who started in their last game last year. And it felt like this year was going to be a little bit more of a step back. And instead, what really happened was Jaylen Brown made enormous progress to the point where you can see him being a regular all-star going forward the next couple of years. Jason Tatum became one of the best scorers in the NBA, and they're 23 and 22 years old. And I think if you look, you can set aside the annoyance of the way the final scenes of their season played out. You have to feel really good about where they're headed and the development that their best players had this year.
So that's interesting. I think you're a little more forgiving of them than I am, because I think they had the more talent between the two teams. I think they had more talent than Miami. Miami played as the better team, but in terms of individual ability, and I'm wondering if there is an immaturity element or a mindset element. So I want to play a little bit of sound. This is from First Take on ESPN. Jason Tatum responding to your colleague Gary Washburn's question about whether the team needs to get tougher heading into next season.
Do we need to get tougher? Nah. Nah, we don't need to get tougher. I mean, it's just kind of unfortunate. You know, some leads we gave up, some missed shots, you know. Every game was close. But get tougher? Nah. We don't need to get tougher.
So that, Chad, is a frustrating answer for me to hear from him as the leader of the franchise. They were up six with 9 minutes to go in this game, and they let it get away. Whether you want to say it's physical toughness or mental toughness, it feels like, yeah, they do need to get tougher.
Yeah, well, I don't really agree on the part that they're the more talented team. I think that they have a higher-end talent at the front of their roster with Tatum and Brown and Kemba Walker to a degree, although I think we're going to find out he got injured in the Toronto series and hasn't been quite right. Gordon Hayward was coming back from the ankle injury, so he really wasn't what he was supposed to be. He was playing his best basketball as a Celtic before that. What Miami had was Bam Adebayo is the best big man in the series by far. We saw that last night. They had a little better perimeter shooting, and they were much deeper. You look at the way Eric Spoelstra ran that team. He didn't really use Andre Iguodala much, but Andre Iguodala, who's been in the finals five times with the Warriors, came in and went 5-for-5 from three last night. The Celtics don't have anybody like that. Kelly Olynyk, who was a starter on their Eastern Conference team 3 years ago, would have played for the Celtics. He couldn't get off the bench for the Heat. So to me, it's not a matter of having more talent or anything like that, or really getting tougher or that sort of thing. I think just what they need is more depth. They need, I joked about it on Twitter, what they need is PJ Brown, James Posey, and Eddie House, the three guys who are their prime bench guys when they won the title in 2008. They didn't have anything like that. They were reliant on young players, which is why you saw Grant Williams sort of out of desperation in the game in the fourth quarter in crunch time, because there wasn't another option there. And you have this rookie who's a 22nd pick out there against Iguodala, who has an argument for the Hall of Fame and knows what has been in more of these situations than just about any current player other than LeBron James. They were overmatched a little bit in this way. And I know I'm probably in the minority, but I look at what happened as growing pains. I don't look at it as some sort of indictment of the toughness of character of this team.
So you wouldn't hope for any major shakeups either on the floor or on the bench in terms of coaching?
For Brad Stevens? Yeah. No. They've gone to the East Finals three times when he's been the coach, and people say, yeah, but he can't get past the East Finals. Well, he's had three completely different teams. The first one, it was a team that had no business being there. It was Isaiah Thomas, a 5'9" shooting point guard, and Avery Bradley and Jay Crowder, who we saw as a flawed player in this series. Yeah. And a team that just wasn't supposed to be in that spot. And they were 4 minutes from knocking out LeBron's Cavaliers. This team was much more talented than that one, but The reason that they got to this point was their young players developed, and they, despite the issues that they had in this series, they generally played really well together this year and had the same goal of you know, winning. It wasn't about point totals or individual things. It was about winning as a team. And, you know, they ran into some roadblocks and some issues in this series. Yeah. But again, I think of that as growing pains. And to me, Brad's not the issue. I know he seems sort of passive, and I wish he had been a little bit more aggressive in this series in certain situations, using his challenges and then using timeouts and that sort of thing.
Yeah, but he seemed very hands-off, which was interesting.
Yeah, but that's what he's always been. Yeah. He's been the Celtics coach longer than he was the Butler coach. People talk about, oh, go back to college. He's a college coach. He's been the NBA longer than he was there.
All right, well, let's hope the growth continues. Let's shift gears a little bit. Pretty good news for the Pats yesterday, especially running back Rex Burkhead.
Fake the handoff to Edelman, looking over at Burkhead. Open space. Nice move, and he's up and over for the touchdown.
Huge day for Burkhead. Pretty good day for the team. What do you make of this new look Pats? Cam Newton, I know you're a fan.
Yeah, he's so charismatic. It's a lot of fun to watch him. And you know, Chris, yesterday we got a look at what it looks like when he doesn't play well. We hadn't really seen that in the first 2 weeks, and he really struggled in the first half against the Raiders. It's like everything was, the calibration on his throws were off, and
even the decision making wasn't right. He's throwing to the wrong guys.
Decision making was bad, in a couple of situations. And yet, with Josh McDaniels and Belichick and Newton and the play of the offensive line, they figured out a way to get that offense going. And they have a really diverse running game. They have an offensive line that, even with the retirement of incredibly accomplished offensive line coach Dante Scarnecchia, appears to be one of the better ones that they've had in recent seasons, and certainly versatile. Yesterday was a really encouraging game for the Patriots because they did it without having to rely on Newton's legs or having to rely on Newton's arm and just sort of spreading the ball around among a variety of running backs. It was really encouraging.
I got to say, Chad, it was a weird experience for me and my five-year-old son, because I was basically saying, I can't wait till Tom Brady gets off my screen so we can watch some basketball. Can you talk a little bit about the comparison between, you just said, Cam Newton, this charismatic, fun character, Tom Brady just kind of chugging along in Tampa Bay?
Yeah, it's strange, isn't it? I mean, I guess it comes with rooting for the laundry, you know, as Seinfeld said, and your perceptions of people change when they're not on the team that you're following or the team that you're pulling for.
I mean, don't get me wrong. Tom Brady's still the greatest of all time. I'm not rooting against the guy.
Thanks for everything, Tom.
Exactly.
It's greatly appreciated.
Exactly.
But you watch him, he doesn't seem like he's enjoying himself. He's got this new team with a lot of really talented players around him. He's sort of got free range with the offense, and yet they win big yesterday, and he seemed kind of miserable at the end of it. And it was very familiar to what we saw last year.
I was just going to say, echoes a lot of what we saw last year from him. Boston Globe Sports columnist Chad Finn. Chad, thanks so much for the time. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Chris.